The big cargo ship probably doesn't have the capabilities for, monitoring and surveillance that the destroyer does.
Japanese investigators wonder why it took an hour for a Philippine cargo ship to report ramming a U.S. destroyer. It's Tuesday, June 20th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. You know, you're part of this program. Join us on any of our VOA Asia social media platforms. Also ahead, BRICS leaders meet in China. Pakistani children learn Mandarin. What is the state of gay rights in China? And we'll meet a U.S. goalkeeper who fasts during Ramadan. That's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. and Japanese authorities say they are investigating why personnel on a U.S. destroyer and a massive Philippine merchant vessel took nearly an hour to report a deadly collision that killed seven U.S. sailors off the coast of Japan. Officials from both countries say the accident was reported by both ships at approximately 2:30 a.m. Saturday, but tracking data shows that the accident happened about an hour earlier. A U.S. 7th Fleet spokesman said the accident appears to have happened at 1:30 Saturday, not 2:30 a.m., as the USS Fitzgerald reported. Nanami Maguro, a spokeswoman for Nippon Yusen, the container ship's operator, said that ship's tracking information showed that it was operating as usual until the collision at 1:30. She did not have any information about the delay in reporting the accident. The collision is being investigated by the U.S. Navy and the Coast Guard and Japan's Coast Guard and its Transport Safety Board. Ralph Kasa is the president of the Pacific Forum at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He told VOA's Victor Beatty he was shocked by the news.
I'm sure there's going to be a significant investigation to try to figure out how something like this could happen. It was, in the middle of the night, but still there's somebody on watch and in command of the ship at all times. So I just don't understand how a vessel of that size could have managed to end up colliding.
Weather was quite clear, according to reports. This doesn't happen very often, does it? One report said it has to go back to 1964 off Australia's coast when something like this happened before.
Yeah, it's certainly not a routine occurrence, and there's certainly going to have to be a very significant investigation. I understand that, the captain was injured, but obviously his career is over, regardless of whether it was his fault or not. These type of things are career enders as well as should be.
Really? Why would you say that?
In the Navy, the captain is responsible. Even if he was, sound asleep in his bunk and his XO was in charge of the ship, at the end of the day, the captain has ultimate responsibility. So I would assume if the past is precedent, which it certainly normally is in the Navy run by tradition, that this will be a career ender for him, unfortunately.
What kind of operations would a ship like the Fitzgerald be conducting in this situation?
Well, I think it was doing some cooperative exercises with the Japanese. We had just finished doing some exercises with the Japanese, and normally you wouldn't expect the destroyer to be out there all by itself. There would be other ships that it would be accompanying or involved with.
The waterways approaching Tokyo Bay, I understand, are very busy. Is that your experience?
Oh, yes. Yeah, this is a very busy waterway, which is why people are always supposed to be quite vigilant in watching out when they're operating. Now, the big cargo ship that collided with it probably doesn't have the kind of capabilities for, monitoring and surveillance that the destroyer does.
That's Ralph Kasa of the Pacific Forum speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. The Fitzgerald's commander, Bryce Benson, was among those evacuated from the ship by helicopter. He was later released from a U.S. naval hospital in Yokosuka, Japan. These are among the top Asia stories trending now on VOAnews.com. American student Otto Warmbier, held in North Korea for 17 months, dies. China steps up control over a disputed South China Sea. BRICS meeting highlights climate change, trade, and terrorism. Four foreign inmates escape from a Bali prison. And South Korea plans to scrap new plans for nuclear power plants. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is at Facebook, at VOA Asia, and on the VOAnews.com website. Thank you. VOA Asia continues. Climate change, trade, and militant attacks were highlighted Monday at a Beijing meeting of foreign affairs officials from Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, known collectively as the BRICS nations. The five nations are seeking to further align their views on key issues at a time when U.S. President Donald Trump is withdrawing the United States from multilateral arrangements such as the Paris Climate Accords and the Trans-Pacific Partnership Deal. Together, the BRICS countries account for roughly 40% of the world population and 20% of the global economy. During a joint news conference after the meeting, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said that China and BRICS members will work together to address global challenges such as terrorism and climate change. He said, "We will continue to uphold the core position of the United Nations in international affairs and push forward the political settlement of hotspot issues. We will continue to uphold a new type of international relations featuring win-win cooperation. We will continue to uphold the authorities of international law in international affairs and work together to address global challenges such as terrorism and climate change." Brazil's Foreign Minister Aloysio Nunes said that the Trump administration's decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Accords should not change what the BRICS countries do. He said, talking about the Paris Climate Agreement, Brazil and the other BRICS member nations have all expressed our concerns, particularly on how we can work with a new agreement after the U.S. announced its withdrawal from the Paris Accord. We are also worried about the decrease of the investment in programs to tackle climate change. The five nations also discussed the threat of international terrorism, with Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov saying, "Terrorism affects all countries, and all countries should cooperate to fight it." He said, "We should enhance the cooperation of the relevant departments of our nations and invite all the parties to join the efforts of anti-terrorist actions. We also need to exchange our data and information in this regard. We have to be aware that no single nation can address the threat of terrorism." Vijay Kumar Singh is India's Minister of State for External Affairs. He said that his country wants to see adoption of the Comprehensive Convention on International Terrorism.
We also ask for expediting the adoption of the Comprehensive Convention on International Terrorism in the UN, which has been pending for some time, and we have support of all members of the BRICS nations.
All five countries are members of the G20, although their economic prospects have declined somewhat amid crises in Brazil and South Africa, and the effects of sanctions lodged against Russia by the West. Leaders of the five nations are due to meet for a summit in the southeastern Chinese city of Xiamen in September. Happening now in Asia, the United Nations says it sees an escalation in the production and use of amphetamines and synthetic drugs as a new threat for communities in Asia. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Happy we're with you. We're with you and you're with us on VOA Asia. China is investing billions of dollars in extensive roads, railways, and special industrial zones and energy infrastructure in Pakistan. Now, the massive collaboration dubbed the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, or CPEC, is generating interest among Pakistani students and professionals to learn Mandarin. Ayaz Gul visited one school in Islamabad.
Li Shui Mei teaches compulsory Mandarin lessons to around 300 students ranging from grade 5 to middle school. She is one of the Chinese instructors at the private Roots Millennium Schools, where more than 7,000 children are learning the language.
They are good and they are very excited to learn Chinese.
She says writing Chinese language characters is challenging for her students, but they quickly master it. The instructor underscores the urgency of learning Mandarin.
I think they need to learn more Chinese, to learn Chinese culture, and they can communicate more, and they can cooperate better with Chinese people, and they can work better.
China's investment of around $60 billion under CPEC collaboration is expected to bring around 20,000 Chinese to Pakistan. A large number of them have already moved to the country, mostly running private businesses. Public and private institutions are establishing links with Chinese counterparts to promote exchanges in higher education and provide research opportunities on both sides of the border. Beijing regards CPEC as a pilot flagship project of its Belt and Road Initiative, which is a massive trade and connectivity venture aimed at linking China to the rest of Asia, Africa, and Europe through both land and maritime routes. While both countries have traditionally enjoyed close political and defense ties, officials hope the corridor will further cement relations and bring economic prosperity to Pakistan.
History bears testimony to the fact that this great friendship has stood the test of time and has moved from strength to strength under successive generation of leaders in both the countries. But in the past 4 years, this relationship has crossed new thresholds and culminated in the establishment of CPEC.
The nearly 3,000-kilometer-long corridor China is building in Pakistan will allow its trade convoys to travel along the Karakoram Highway, snaking past snow-capped ranges down to the deep-water Pakistani port of Gwadar. The freight will then be placed on ships bound for markets in Africa, the Middle East, and Europe. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
And you're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia. An Asian-American band won a Supreme Court case over what some called its offensive trademark. Some said the group's name, The Slants, constituted a racial slur. The court disagreed. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia's Facebook. This is VOA Asia. This past Sunday, a cruise ship where 9 Chinese gay and transgender couples were wed at sea returned to Shanghai. The ship had set sail for Japan on Wednesday, and the couples were wed on Thursday in a group ceremony. The newlywed couples who disembarked from the ship after it arrived in Shanghai Sunday morning said they were grateful for the wedding and the experience they shared with those on the cruise. The couples were accompanied by about 800 supporters. For some perspective on their struggle, I spoke with Ross Murray, the program's director for GLAAD, a leading lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender advocacy group here in the United States. He told me that while there has been some progress in LGBTQ rights in mainland China, there's still a long way to go.
Well, in my experience with Chinese LGBTQ advocates and them talking about, you know, their situation, the way that I see it as an outsider to China has been that there really is some really strong cultural understandings of family and of people, and that has been the probably the biggest challenge, that there's not an anti-LGBTQ movement the way that you often see in other countries, and partly because the role of religion in China is very different than it exists in other countries. But there really is a strong understanding of heritage, carrying on your family lineage, having children, keeping the family name alive. And so if you come out, that is, you know, one way that often is difficult for acceptance, is that people question, like, what's going to happen? Are you going to have children? Will the family name continue? And so there is not recognition for marriage equality in China, but people have left China to be married. Just in 2015, 10 couples from China won a trip to West Hollywood and were married by the mayor of West Hollywood in the United States because it was legal in California at that time. And what was really interesting about this was that these 10 couples won a contest that was sponsored by a subsidiary of Alibaba, which is a major online retailer in China, a huge force for culture, and they facilitated this, but they also recognized that China didn't have any recognition for same-sex couples.
Now, you do mention that the carrying on of the family name is important in China. Here in the United States, it's important too, but here it seems easier for same-sex couples, now that the Supreme Court has decided, to get married and to adopt children and to carry on the family name that way. But you're saying that's not the case in China?
It's a little bit of a different comparison in terms of how that looks and works. One, family configurations have looked somewhat different in the United States now for a little while, too, and in terms of grafting in of families and blended families and divorce and remarriages and step-parents and things like that. And I think I even read an article a couple of weeks ago that talked about acceptance for at least gay and lesbian Chinese people sometimes was easier when they would have a child. Because one of the assumptions is that if you are LGBTQ, that you're not going to have children. But we also recognize in this day and age that people are doing that through adoption, through surrogacy, through other processes, that people actually do keep their lineage and their heritage alive.
What steps do you think that LGBTQ people in China can take to help along how they can have a relationship, how they can get married, or how they can have or adopt children?
One of the things we believe at GLAAD is that it is the continued telling of real people's stories that is going to make a huge difference for people, and that as family and friends come to know people who are lesbian or gay or bisexual or transgender or even queer, that they are going to start to see them as real people and perhaps not the caricatures that they have come to understand or see, perhaps more stereotypically viewed in the media. And once they sort of know their real everyday lives, that they are going to want the care and protection and well-being for their own friends and family. And I think it's going to take a while, and that needs to happen both on an interpersonal level and inside the family, but can also happen on a wide level in things like media that gets consumed by a large number of people all at the same time.
Ross Murray is the program's director of the Global and U.S. South Division of GLAAD, a leading LGBTQ advocacy group here in the United States. The marriage cruise was held soon after Taiwan had taken its first steps towards legalizing same-sex marriage. It is not illegal to be gay in China, though homosexuality was regarded as a mental disorder there until 2001. Stories developing at this hour in Asia. Pakistani police say gunmen ambushed a Navy vehicle, killing two Navy men and wounding three others in the southwestern coastal town of Jiwani. Keep up with the latest news your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Turning now to technology on VOA Asia, the clinging power of octopus tentacles has inspired a breakthrough new adhesive patch that works on wet and oily surfaces with potentially huge medical and industrial uses. A research team from Sungkyung Kwan University put an octopus's suction cups under a microscope, and they found that its impressive suction power was thanks to small balls inside the suction cups that line each of the tentacles. Professor Chung Yong Pang said that they had managed to fabricate polymer patches covered with micro-suction cups with a patch so strong that if it was the size of a thumbnail, it could lift an object of up to 400 grams in water.
Previously, people tried to investigate some simple surface like the lotus leaf or shark skin. However, currently, we try to investigate some particular architecture and their unknown function or unknown structure. So we have a big curiosity of this structure.
The new wet-tolerant adhesive patch has been hailed as a breakthrough by the country's science and technology ministry And there are hopes that it will be able to be used for everything from heavy industry to dressing wounds. Professor Pang said it can be used repeatedly, with one patch surviving more than 10,000 cycles of attachment and detachment without losing its suction power.
Actually, the conventional one needs to large volume, so they have relatively large size, but in our device can make some miniaturized structure that has a really strong adhesion.
The patch could be used for medical purposes, including to help suture wounds, as they do not contain any chemical adhesives and will not irritate skin. Professor Pang said there is currently no adhesive system that can maintain its grip in water without using strong chemicals.
Our device can apply to medical patch with the stem cell and wearable electronic device. It works on dry and wet surface, so can be used on the water. It'll be very promising.
The research team expects it to take around 3 years for the breakthrough to come into commercial use. This Saturday will mark the end of Ramadan, the Muslim holy month, and for billions of people, it's a time of reflection, honoring the first revelation of the Quran to Muhammad. It is also a month of fasting, during which able-bodied Muslims abstain from food and drink from sunrise to sunset. Now, that poses a unique challenge for professional athletes. VOA's Arash Arabasadi tells us about one football player who keeps his fast even though he has to play professional soccer.
Bilal Hamid is a star goalkeeper for Washington's Major League Soccer club, DC United.
Now, obviously, this isn't a big soccer country, but I've been a massive soccer fan my whole life. It's a big part of my family and a part of where my family originates from.
Hamid, who goes by Bill, is a first-generation American whose Muslim family comes from Sierra Leone. He prays with them before games and alone when he takes the field.
I'm usually standing on my goal line. I'll say Al-Fatiha right before the game. Right when we cross the white line, I'll say another Al-Fatiha. And then just from there, I just focus my mind solely on that game.
But this month is Ramadan, and able-bodied Muslims are required to fast. And so Hamid balances his faith with his professional life.
It's not easy being on the field, especially in times like this where the heat is, it is going to get bad. So I want to have the right things in my body to make sure I'm, you know, giving myself the energy and the strength to play as well as I can.
Otherwise, Hamid says, he follows tradition.
But I know if we don't have a game coming up, I'm going to make the right choice and I'm going to fast and make sure I get my prayers in and make sure that the things that I put in my life are the right choices on those days that I'm fasting.
A disciplined labor of love.
It's not easy to be a faithful servant in this religion, but nothing's meant to be easy, so you just have to do your best.
Hamid is one of the best goalkeepers in Major League Soccer, and he also plays for the U.S. national team. But it's the lessons he learned from his family and faith that guide his life on and off the field. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Now, you can get our program on iTunes. You can also find it on SoundCloud. You can download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. And you can find us at voanews.com. Let us hear from you, VOA Asia Facebook, and you can send us an email at voaasia@voanews.com. Want to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith. Want to give a shout-out to some of our listeners and affiliates, including Myanmar's Facebook VOA Burmese and the voice of Changjung, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Changjung Christian University in Tainan, Taiwan, and DZUP 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines, Diliman, in Diliman, Quezon City, in the Philippines. Our managing editor is Diane Gao. Thanks also to the rest of my teammates, Jim Stevenson, Ali Ogden, and our interns, Harry Chen and Vivi Ren. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy the rest of your day.